You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Step into the China Shop. We've got another amazing interview episode lined up for you. But first, as always, I'm Shopkeeper Dan. With me is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I'm doing good. I'm starting to feel like a real journalist or something, right?
Like a legit media personality, for
right?
Sure.
Yeah, getting accredited authors and
yes,
like people reaching out to us. It's amazing.
Yes. Did you want me to introduce our guest or did you want to do it?
Go ahead.
All right. Today, folks, we are so thrilled to have James Falk, author of
Financial Cold War.
Financial Cold War. I have not gotten a chance to read it, but we were, Kyle and I, rifling through it today, talking about the different parts we were seeing. How are you doing today, James? Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me onto the show. I'm doing great. Thanks.
So you're based in Hong Kong, I think you said?
Yes, that's right.
So I do have to ask, because it seems like some of the material in the book, as I was looking through it, is kind of critical to China. Are you concerned about putting this into print? Like, is that something you have to worry about?
No, not at all. I mean, it's critical, I hope. Constructively so, and it's at least as critical of other parties as well as China.
That is true.
The main thing that I was looking to do with the book is really to try and explain some of the sources of tension between China and America, rather than to take a particular position or side on it.
Why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of the setup for how we found ourselves entering into a financial Cold War?
Look, the financial Cold War, as I define it in the book, is probably a bit different to the way a lot of people think about it. When you say financial Cold War, people are thinking about trade wars, sanctions, etc. What the financial Cold War is, as I define it, is really the fundamental conflict embedded in the structure of the global financial system and national financial policies over the distribution of wealth and income. Mm-hmm. And the central theme of the book is really that the structure of the system is driving higher levels of inequality, which are spilling over into greater social tensions between China and America, spilled into what I call a geoeconomic war, which is the sanctions, is the trade war, etc. But what it is really is looking at the imbalances in the system and the bad incentives and the things that need to be repaired with the system in order to de-escalate tensions.
Is there, I mean, China's obviously got a different system of government than the U.S. does, and I'm assuming their markets do operate differently. But it is interesting to see that they have kind of the same economic disparities or discrepancies that are starting to emerge in the U.S. So what exactly are those differences? Like, how does China's financial markets operate compared to the U.S.'s?
Look, China's come from a very different place. I mean, when they started reform and opening up under Deng Xiaoping in the late 70s, China was dirt poor. They didn't have financial markets. They've been closed down for decades. And the country, as it engaged in the infrastructure upgrading, the development of the economy, that they had to create financial markets. But what they created was very much a controlled system, that the controls reflected several things. Part of it was an inherent distrust of capitalism and financial markets. Mm. After all, the leadership is still nominally a communist party, but also the controls over the financial system really reflected a lot of the difficulties that they had when they were building their financial markets and some of the pressures that, that they were under at the time.
Mm-hmm. Starting from scratch, basically, like you said, and doing it so quickly, have there been growing pains just associated with that in general? Because it's kind of hard to throw a whole system together in, you know, course of a couple decades.
There were a huge number of growing pains, and you know, by and large, if you look at it objectively, the Chinese Communist Party has done a remarkable job developing both the economy, the infrastructure, and delivering a moderate level of prosperity for most of the population in a record period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But inevitably, you know, as they ran through that, it created a whole load of imbalances. You know, some of those are reflected in financial markets. Some of those are reflected in growing wealth disparities. One of the things that's most focused on is the environmental consequences of China's development model.
Yeah, we noticed within the last couple of years that they're actually selling canned air. People in China were purchasing. Like, what was that movie, Spaceballs?
yeah.
I hadn't seen that. But I mean, the environmental damage of industrialization in China has been huge. And just frankly, because the population is so big, that the level of impact has been unprecedented.
As far as the population goes, though, China has got some pretty strict laws regarding like how many children you can have. Is that something that... I mean, I would think that would create kind of like a population bubble as like the elderly, like you have a big boom in one generation as they start to I don't know, trying to think of a polite way to say die. as that generation moves on,
I think the point that you make is good. In fact, just to clear up if there's any misunderstanding, China no longer has a one-child policy, and in fact
that's right, I do remember saying that, yes,
that the government really does want people to have more babies. But you hit the nail on the head, and it's actually what one of the things that is talked about in my book, which is that, you know, China has had this huge one-time demographic dividend.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because you had a sort of baby boom generation like you had, you know, in many parts of the West after the Second World War, but also because they had a one-child policy imposed in the late 1970s and which persisted until recent. That increase in working-age population came with a reduction in the number of dependents. So there were more and more people working, being productive and earning, and fewer people that they had to feed, mm-hmm. and rely on. So that created a huge amount of savings in the system, which the government was then able to channel into developing its infrastructure that's really powered the growth of the Chinese economy.
I'm sorry that this is turning into a, like, what's the difference between the U.S. and China? But, you know, it's hard to pass up that opportunity when you get a chance to talk to somebody who's living there or in Hong Kong.
No, not at all. I mean, it's an interesting topic. And really, I mean, what I found, you know, dealing at the intersection of China and the international capital markets was that there was a huge amount of lack of knowledge and misunderstanding on both sides.
I mean, because all we see is just, you know, someone tweets about China, you know, human rights, and then next thing you know that they're getting shut down, China's bristling and angry, and they're pulling movies. And
yeah, there's a bit of that, but actually the portrayal I find in a lot of the media that I read in the West is fairly imbalanced. It's almost like people are sort of programmed to think, you know, well, communism's bad. I watched some 1980s movie, and then, you know, China must be bad, and they must be repressing their people. Actually, the reality is quite different. I mean, the vast majority of people in China, and I studied as an undergraduate in Beijing in the mm-hmm. 1990s, so I've had a real close up view of of the changes. But for the vast majority of people, actually, they've done really well over the past 40 years, and you know, they're richer, they're happier, they can feed themselves for a start. And so the portrayal that you get sometimes outside of China about, you know, a long-suffering people, you know, repressed by its government is a bit inaccurate.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and move on from that then, and let's talk about some of the stuff that the book does cover. As far as, like, what are you seeing as, like, the major source of the tensions between the two countries, and then how are you proposing that can be negotiated?
The fundamental point here is that rising inequalities in both countries are driving greater social tensions, and those social tensions are building up. And rather than addressing the sources of social tensions, what you've seen in both countries is that your leaderships have tended to deflect the problems and blame outside forces for those. You know, whether it's, you know, in China, Trump saying that China's raping our people and stealing our jobs, or you know, some of the things that are said.
He did say that, didn't he?
Yeah, he actually did. And you know, and equally, some of the things that are said in China, particularly, you've seen this wolf warrior diplomacy that's been, you know, quite vocal in attacking America. I think that a lot of that's been fairly unconstructive, because it is neither addressed the fundamental problems that are leading to these social tensions, and, you know, it's escalating tensions between the two countries that make it more and more difficult to de-escalate, you know, when you run into problems.
So then what is the answer then? Like, how do you tackle that kind of inequality? That's something that's systemic, almost, the systems that basically the societies are founded upon.
It's systemic insofar as the financial system and the structure of it have created those outcomes. There are many aspects to this, but one of the biggest lines of attack that I take in the book are really that the dollar-centric global monetary system that was put in place at the end of the Second World War, quite frankly, was a bad idea from the start, and it has been at the root of many problems around the world, not just between the US and China. And when you look at the dollar problem, I think, you know, there's a lot of a sense, you know, both inside America and outside America, that actually this has been a huge privilege for America. In fact, there's a French finance minister which coined the term exorbitant privilege. But actually, the reality is that for most people in America today, that the dollar serving this global utility role for the rest of the world is not actually such a good thing, because it's actually one of the major drivers of a lot of the imbalances and a lot of the inequalities that you're seeing. And you know, maybe if I can kind of explain a little bit about how that works.
Yes, please.
You've got to look at it from multiple perspectives. So the fact that the dollar serves as this global utility, every currency effectively references the dollar in its exchange rate, and it's the most widely held reserve asset, and it's the most widely used currency in trade. This has created a demand for dollars outside the system. And in order to support the growth in trade and investment around the rest of the world, the US has basically had to continuously export dollars. So that you don't have a liquidity crunch in the rest of the world, which has basically meant that the US has had to run continuous balance of payments deficits, which is fine as long as the US economy is growing at least as fast a pace as the rest of the world. But, you know, the US is a large, mature economy, and, you know, that's clearly not happening now.
Right.
And so the dollar serving this role has basically meant that the US has had to go into ever higher levels of debt to be able to supply this liquidity to the rest of the world. Then yeah, if you take a look at from the perspective of other countries, mm-hmm. there's a sense in the US, and to some extent it's true, but it's not entirely fair, that you know a lot of these kind of emerging markets are pegging to the dollar. They're artificially holding their currencies down to steal US jobs. Well, the reality, if you look at it from their perspective, is that because most less developed countries, governments, and corporates have to borrow in there's your dog. Yeah. Have to because most of the rest of the world's governments or less developed countries, governments and corporates have to borrow in US dollars. Mm-hmm. When you have periodic bouts of dollar volatility where their currencies fall sharply against the dollar, then it becomes more difficult to repay these debts. You have bankruptcies, you have corporate insolvencies, you have job losses, and a huge amount of economic misery wrought. And these sorts of emerging markets crises really persisted throughout the 1980s and 1990s. And it came to a point after the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s that emerging market governments started getting a little bit smarter about it, which was that they started building up reserves of dollars in order to ensure themselves against those periodic bouts of currency volatility. So what that meant, you know, when you look at it from the perspective of the US, then is that the dollar, which was already structurally overvalued, became even more structurally overvalued. So as these emerging markets were growing economically and increasing their level of productivity, that the US currency, which should have been the pressure release valve, wasn't able to adjust to the higher level of productivity growth elsewhere as compared with the US. And US manufacturing exports became less and less competitive. Now, how this fell on you in US society really depends where you sit. So if you were a wealthy shareholder of a large US corporate that was able to take advantage of this and move production out to lower cost centers, then you know, you did really well because the companies drove their costs down, they increased their profit margins, and your share price went up. But if you were a US manufacturing worker, it really wasn't so great for you, because
right.
what you saw was essentially job losses, displacement, or at best wage stagnation. And what I argue here in the book is that if you look at it from the perspective of the majority of people in the US today, that the dollar system really isn't working for them.
Mm-hmm. Man, feels like...
Yeah, just going to class in economics school. Like, I didn't know this.
I know. It's like, I'm trying to...
Sorry, I didn't mean to be boring.
No, it's not boring. You're blowing our minds.
No, it's fascinating. I'm just having a hard time even thinking of follow-up questions. I'm trying to process everything you're saying. Like, God, I never even thought of any of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm just like, and then what happened?
Right?
to maybe answer that and take it a step further. Look, I mean, the dollar system is clearly a big part of it, but you know, the dollar's not the only problem in the structure of the global financial system. I mean, as trade and investment has globalized, you know, all countries have wanted to attract investment to them. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a fact of life that capital is more mobile than labor. So when you increase taxes on people, you know, people can move their money very quickly. It's not necessarily so quick to get up and sell your house and move to a different country.
Right.
And so what has happened is that countries started to compete with each other on the basis of low taxes, which has made it more and more difficult for governments to raise the revenue that they needed from, frankly, the people who have the income to support that. And so what you've seen around the world, you know, as this global fiscal competition has taken place, is that you've had, you know, ever more illogical tax systems, at least from a perspective of social equity, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, wealthy people have actually in many places paid far lower rates of taxation than your average middle class workers, because the taxes on their sources of income, which have tended to be more capital based,
typically capital gains, yep,
exactly, have been much lower than, you know, the income taxes that you pay on your salary.
Yeah, and that's something that I think was talked about in the latest election, wanting to try to do some kind of tax on assets, and I just don't know how that's going to work.
The problem is really one that is very difficult for any country to solve on its own, because mm-hmm. you know, if you start taxing assets, what will happen is that, you know, your rich people will start getting up and moving to different places. So, yeah, actually, well, one of the things that, you know, has, I think, been a positive development, you know, with the new administration was that, you know, Janet Yellen pushed to create this global minimum corporate tax rate, mm-hmm. and, you know, which was approved and supported by the G7. Now, yeah, that's a baby step, and, you know, frankly the agreement that was created needs a lot more teeth to it. But until and unless you can get countries to stop competing with each other on the basis of ever lower taxes, mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to start raising taxes on the rich and creating more progressive tax system or fairer tax systems.
Sounds like there's a lot of different things that need to happen for things to get better.
It's almost kind of depressing to hear all these things kind of laid out and like what needs to happen, and just thinking like, God, I don't, like, is there anybody working towards this?
Well, I think that there are steps, that there are baby steps being taken, like the G7 agreement on global minimum corporate tax. But what I found was that actually the problem isn't really particularly well understood. Most people in financial markets don't really have a good grasp of a lot of this stuff. And, you know, even top policymakers who are making financial policies that don't, they get the problems, but they don't have a granular enough understanding of the structure of the financial system to mm-hmm. be able to design the sort of policies that might be able to effectively tackle these problems.
I gotta take a breath and process all this.
So, I mean, that was a big motivator for me for writing the book, which was that I saw a lot of these problems. I'd been I'd had a rare opportunity to work at the intersection of financial markets and policy, and, you know, particularly between the US and China and other international markets. And I felt I was in a fairly rare position to be able to identify the problems and also be able to explain them and articulate them in a granular enough way for people to understand.
So what do you do now? It says that you used to work at the Hong Kong Exchange. All right. Are you a professor?
No, not at all. I barely managed to get my undergraduate degree. So too much time spent in the college bar. But
right.
I left the exchange in July, but actually my background was that, you know, after I graduated, I went to work in an investment bank in London, mm-hmm. and then, you know, I had a career in investment banking covering the financial services sector. And by almost by accident, I ended up working at Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing at a time when China was accelerating the internationalization of its capital markets. Now, frankly, you know, exchanges clearing settlement is probably about the unsexiest area of financial services that you can imagine. I mean, if you've ever sat in a room with someone for a couple of hours, having them talk to you about clearing and settlements, it's pretty difficult to stay awake. But what I found was that I started getting invited to breakfast with finance ministers, getting invited to consulates for lunch, and it sort of occurred to me that some of this stuff that I was dealing with might be quite important, and actually it is. It's critically important, mm-hmm. but it's also one of the areas that's really not very well understood. You know, it's in the sort of front office financial services, you know, you're mostly kind of chasing deals, you know, M&A deals, IPOs, etc. You're not really thinking about the plumbing of the system. Mm. On the other side, you know, most people who are working on the plumbing system, you know, really the back and middle office of these infrastructures or financial institutions, you know, they're very focused on the operations. They're cogs in the wheel who are very rarely able to take a step back and actually look at, you know, the macro implications of this. And you know, I was running strategy for the exchange, and so as the exchange was trying to exploit the internationalization of the Chinese capital markets to grow its business, I found myself at this kind of really fascinating intersection of your financial markets and policy. And you know, it brings together a lot of different disciplines, because you're looking not only at macroeconomics, you're looking at financial markets, you're looking at legal systems, you're looking at regulation, technology, and so forth. And you know, they're really what I found was that, you know, that I can probably count on my hands and feet, you know, the number of people around the world who actually have, you know, the holistic macro top down and then granular bottom up understanding of the system. And you know, actually even fewer of those are actually working in your financial services themselves.
Do you have any names that we can talk to?
there are a few, but I mean, it's quite a wild array of people, because you know, you've got you know, people who are, you know, there are people who are macro focused who are sitting, you know, in the infrastructures that control the plumbing, but you know, the types of people also who you kind of come across, you know, they're the various people who are I guess in the sort of murkier parts of the murkier parts of the sort of political economic system. And you know, it's fascinating.
You said you just left in July. That was of 21?
Yeah, that's right.
So were you there when the whole fiasco with Lucan happened?
Lucan?
The coffee maker that...
Lucan, okay. Yeah, it's like you know, you have things like Enron in the US. I mean, right. There's always been a sort of steady stream of corporate scandals and frauds and so forth.
But that led to, because I think there was, like, there's the threat of delisting a lot of Chinese companies from the U.S. markets now at this point, unless they conform to the U.S. reporting standards. I thought that kind of all stemmed from the Lucan or collapse.
It was one of the disclosure question has been an ongoing issue, and mm-hmm. that was one of the catalysts. But the SEC has been pushing for better disclosure of audit papers and other things from Chinese companies. And
I guess my question is, would that have actually prevented anything? Or would they have been just lied there too?
Well, look, I mean, the reality is that you have corporate scandals all over the world.
Oh, everywhere. Yeah. I'm not saying that China's more susceptible.
Better disclosure definitely helps, but mm-hmm. but I don't think it's a silver bullet that's going to prevent corporate frauds and other misdeeds happening ever again.
We just had a trial wrap up with Theranos that
yes, I was following that a little bit.
Yes, definitely not. Every country has their own.
So what were some of the big things that China did that you would classify as being part of the Cold War?
Well, I think the financial Cold War, it's really the policies that have been put in place in China that have contributed to the wealth and income inequality that's developed there. And actually, some of those policies were deliberately pursued, and actually for good reason, because as I said earlier on, when China kind of started opening up in the late 70s and early 80s, it just come out of the Cultural Revolution, and the country was dirt poor. Mm-hmm. It was technologically backwards. And they had to import a lot of technology. They had to modernize the economy, and they needed to create incentives to do that. So they as Deng Xiaoping advised the Chinese people, it wanted some people to go ahead and get rich, and so the tax system in China was set up to give incentives for entrepreneurs to go and set up businesses and mm-hmm. so forth. But I'd say that one of the biggest drivers of China's development to the level that it's reached today has been the harnessing of Chinese people's savings. So the banking system in China is largely state-owned, and so that's given a huge amount of power to the government to mm-hmm. decide how capital was allocated and even how capital was priced in the system. And using that power, it was able to go ahead and develop a lot of the roads, hospitals, railways, and other infrastructure that the country needed to develop. But that over a period of time led to this economic model that was very dependent on top-down decision making and very dependent particularly on investment. And as you pointed out earlier, given the demographic cliff that the country faces with its rapidly aging population, that model, if it's persisted with, will lead to more and more misallocation of capital into more industrial capacity, more homes and apartment buildings that you aren't necessarily going to need for people to live in because the population's shrinking. And as that capital is misallocated, then you're going to see a drag on China's growth, and the level of prosperity that it's reached now may start to taper off.
That sounds familiar. Is that kind of what Jack Ma got in trouble for when he was criticizing the banking systems of China, or was that about something else?
Well, I mean, what he said, he criticized. I can't remember the exact words that he used, but he was criticizing the system, for starving small and medium sized enterprises from capital. Now, mm-hmm. that's something which is not just a problem in China, but actually
right.
it is a problem based on the incentive structures for banks all around the world.
Okay, so that was something a little different then.
But he made the criticism, you know, set against the backdrop, you know, because they were at the time trying to float Ant.
Yeah, that was when they're trying to get. Yep.
And you know, they were at the sort of back stages of the IPO, and then the regulators pulled the IPO at the 11th hour.
Yeah, that Alibaba's stock has not done too well since then.
Well, I think that there's a lot of that you know, reams of newspaper commentary, you know, that you know, insinuate or explicitly say that, you know, that this is, you know, the Chinese government got upset with Jack Ma's comments, and so they're cracking down on him, and you know, that's
kind of what it felt like. But I remember reading his comments, and I didn't think they were that bad. I thought he was just pointing out a system. It seemed more constructive, I thought, when I read it.
Well, the way that I look at this, and you know, I may or may not be correct, but you know, the issue, if you leave aside the your possible kind of power play between the Chinese government and its wealthy entrepreneurs, it really came down to a couple of regulatory issues, which was that, you know, this business had kind of grown from nowhere and become gigantic, and you know, it was much more lightly regulated than, you know, traditional banks. Mm-hmm. And so when it was going out and extending loans and not having to maintain the same level of capital backing as a bank would, you know, clearly it's going to be more competitive than a bank. But you know, what happens when you start to see financial losses? You know, so there was a regulatory issue to do with that. And you know, because it was coming at the same time as the IPO, there are a huge number of retail investors into the IPO. And as long as this issue over the regulation, and particularly that the capital levels that Ant might have to hold, there was a huge uncertainty for investors who were going into that, because if they invest in the IPO and then suddenly the government or the central bank imposed higher capital requirements on it, you could have seen that stock price plummet. So there was an investor, mm-hmm. there was an investor protection issue as well. So I think, you know, those aspects, I think, unfortunately, were less focused on in a lot of the media commentary that I saw, you know, in favor of the more sensationalist, you know, that this is a, you know, Jack Ma's out of favor with the party type of commentary.
It didn't help that he disappeared for a month too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, if you know, I'd had a sort of multi-billion IPO pulled, you know, at the last minute, you know, I might not want to be too sociable for a little while after as well.
I don't know. You still have billions. I mean, it's not like you lost everything.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or he didn't.
No, he didn't.
And you could still go have your caviar and smoked Eskimos or whatever the rich people
smoked
eat.
Smoked Eskimos.
I don't know. I'm not rich.
Yeah,
is that not a delicacy?
I don't know. It doesn't sound that appetizing to me. But maybe if I were rich,
right? So what's next for you then? This book looks like it's fairly recent. I mean, I did see references to COVID. I thought maybe it was a little older. It looks like it probably took a lot of time to put together.
It took a bit of time to come together. It's actually just come out this month. Mm-hmm. So I'm busy at the moment. I was slightly naive, frankly, writing the book, because I figured that, you know, you write a book and you hand it to the publisher, and then, you know, they would deal with everything, and you'd be done.
No, I
hadn't realized that, you know, that then there was all the kind of, well, you might have to go and sort of publicize and talk about your book to get people to buy it. So I'm spending a lot of time on that at the moment. But once I'm through that, I'll look at what's next. Probably try and get back into some sort of gainful employment again.
Do you have any other projects that you're working on in the meantime, or is this has basically got all your focus?
No. I do a couple of non-executive things. One of which is with a digital asset custodian called Hex Trust here in Hong Kong. So there's
what is that?
It provides kind of safekeeping and you know, other collateral services for digital assets. So you know, cryptocurrencies, stable coins, NFTs, and so forth.
Didn't China just kick out like all Bitcoin mining and other cryptos? Or
China has, but I mean Hong Kong runs a separate.
Oh, I keep forgetting that they kind of have their own separate.
Yeah, it's a separate legal and regulatory system.
Danny, have any other questions about the book or anything else for?
So nobody got killed, even though it was a war.
Well, not yet, but serious point though, and I think you know one of the things that I thought it was a really important topic for someone to write about, but you know the typically with these sorts of books, you know, you have you know people who write about you know government policy, or you have people write about financial markets, and typically a lot of that's fairly dry, and it's targeted really at a specialist audience. Just given you know, how much financial markets affect each and every one of our lives, I wanted to write something that actually was you know readable, digestible, and hopefully enjoyable for you know the intelligent layman. And so you know, a lot of the book actually covers the history of how the Chinese and American financial systems came about. And you know, amongst that, there are a lot of quite interesting stories and colorful characters. And you know, I'm hoping that, you know, that this arms people with the information that allows them to be more informed in the debates on these issues, but also to help them better hold their political leaders to account to deal with some of these issues.
That was one of the things that really struck me when I was looking through was the how much attention was paid to the research and the background information of the two countries. So I think you did a fantastic job with that personally.
Thank you. I can't claim all the credit, you know, because I was ready. Because we were in COVID lockdown, and we've got young kids, so my wife thought that I might be sort of going nuts, so she sort of sent me off to create a project for myself, and so I started writing this book. And you know, as I was writing it, I was showing her you know, each section as I wrote it, and you know, she gave me very valuable feedback in the form of you know, well, okay, I get the arguments, but you know, this is really boring to read. you got to put in some stories and history or anecdotes to kind of really liven this up. And you know, so the credit for a lot of that actually goes to her. But hopefully, it's a book that's you know entertaining as well as being informative and thought-provoking.
I like it because I mean you've got stuff about the Cuban Missile Crisis on the one end. There's just stuff about everything in here.
Yeah.
Well, if you get a chance to read it more closely, I'd love to have your full feedback at some point. But I hope that people find it useful and an enjoyable read.
I can't imagine my feedback would be useful to you. I think we're on two completely different levels of understandings of the markets.
Well, that's what makes me want to read it all the more.
I do appreciate, yes, hopefully bridge that gap a little bit.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on and being a part of the China Shop today, James. This has been fantastic. I really am going to get on that book. I just have a long list of stuff to be reading, but I am really interested in this subject, and you do a great job of setting it up and explaining it. So I just really wanted to sincerely thank you for coming by and chatting with us today.
Thank you both very much.
Where can people find your book?
So it'll be available from all major booksellers, Amazon. If you want to get links to booksellers, you can go to my website, which is jamesafok.com. That's jamesafok.com.
No spaces or dots?
No spaces or dots.
Okay. We'll make sure we link all that stuff too in the episode description.
Thank you very much.
All right. Is there anything else you want to promote? Any socials, or are you on Twitter yet?
I'm not a huge social media user.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Though.
You got to do it if you want to promote it.
I went on LinkedIn, so I'm on that.
LinkedIn's a good one. Okay. Yeah. That's probably good enough for you.
There you go. Prospective employers, find James on LinkedIn.
Yep, fingers crossed.
Yeah, just friends.
All right. Well, Kyle, any parting words before we head out of here?
I had one other thought, but it was from a book I read about a decade ago, so I'm not even sure if it's pertinent anymore, and I don't want to sound like an idiot, so I'm just going to skip that one.
Okay, well, that's staying in the episode. I'm not editing that out.
That's fine.
Fair enough. All right, folks, thanks for joining us. We'll be back at you soon with another episode. And until next time, happy trades. We'll see you later, Kyle. And thanks for joining us once more, James Falk.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2bullsinachinashop.com. Make sure you check us out. Download us on any streaming network. Blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate, subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.